everybody. Did you miss me? This is Dr. Colby Taylor, the host of the Abnormal Psychologist podcast. And I know I've been out of pocket for a little bit. I had been meaning to post episodes with more frequency. I feel like I say that at the beginning of every episode, but I really did mean to post episodes more frequently. But I've been running around like my hair's been on fire for like the last month. It's been sort of crunch time in my academic job, right? Because we're in the middle of the spring semester. There's only a few weeks left in class. I also hosted a high school quiz bowl tournament this past weekend. And so there was a lot of logistical stuff that went into that. Had almost 100 high schoolers that were on campus, which was pretty cool. And I'm super passionate about quiz bowl. I did quiz bowl, knowledge bowl, what have you, academic bowl, whatever y'all call it in your neck of the woods. Just about every place has some sort of quiz bowl team. I did that in high school. I've done some volunteer coaching. I'm obviously really passionate about trivia. And so it's kind of neat to actually host a tournament. But I swear, it took 2 years off my life handling the logistics of all that and everything. And then, of course, parenting, right? I've had my two kids. They've had some sort of sinus infection or allergies or something. It just seems like having kids, they're always sick. Anyways, I was going through old mailbag emails, and I found one from 2021 asking me to do an episode on ABA, or Applied Behavior Analysis. This came from Megan, and I'm sorry this got lost in the shuffle. I'm actually lecturing about ABA in my autism class, and so I thought, like, there couldn't be a better time for me to do an episode on ABA. So that's going to be the focus of today's episode. And over the course of this episode, I'll try to define what ABA is. We'll try to talk about the history of ABA a little bit, some of the controversies related to ABA, and I'll just generally try to make sense for you all and for myself of the alphabet soup that can go along with ABA. So we can dive in. The first thing with alphabet soup, ABA, it's not the American Law Association. Isn't that ABA, like the American Law Association? I don't know. It's not the American Bowling Association. It stands for Applied Behavior Analysis. One of the things I found about ABA over the years, I've practiced ABA. I've looked at a lot of research around ABA. And ABA can look very different based on the practitioner. It's something that's become incredibly popular due to its effectiveness and the effectiveness data behind it in treating autism spectrum disorder, and then sort of generalizing the treatment of other disorders. But ABA can look very different depending on the practitioner, depending on the setting, depending on what sort of subtype of ABA is being run. And I know at least here in Memphis, it seems like there's ABA sites that have popped up in strip malls all around town. And so even though everything is sort of under the auspice of ABA, it can look very different from practitioner to practitioner. But there are some defining features of ABA. Again, I said it stands for Applied Behavior Analysis. And one of the articles that I really like to recommend to students is by Bear, Wolf, and Risley. And it was written back in 1968. And it sort of comes up with these seven core defining dimensions of ABA. And then obviously looking at that acronym, the first defining dimension is that ABA is applied. We're not doing bench science here. We're not removed from the people that we're trying to treat. We are in the trenches. This is applied. We are doing programs to help with people's everyday lives. Right. One of the really cool things I like about ABA is there's a lot of hypothesis testing that's involved, and you can sit down with a patient or the patient's family, try to figure out what sort of problem behavior or what sort of skill you want to teach, and you can address it. So very much applied, sort of a roll up your sleeves and get to work sort of therapy. It's also behavioral. So obviously we're not working on dream interpretation or subconscious thoughts. This is not hypnotism. This is very much, and we'll get into this when I talk about history, in the tradition of John B. Watson and B.F. Skinner. We're looking at overt, definable, measurable behaviors. And that measurable piece is important because it's also analytic. And this is not analytic in sort of the psychoanalytic Freudian type of analytic. This is analytic sort of in the mathematical sense. You are doing hypothesis testing. You're using Excel or SPSS to create graphs to look and see using numbers quantitatively if what you're doing is working, which is really cool. It's very scientific. And if you're a data geek, sort of like me, you really like sort of the analytic nature of ABA. Going back to this bear, wolf, and grizzly article, it's applied, it's behavioral, it's analytic. We covered the three pieces of the ABA acronym, but it's also technological. And this sort of technological aspect is not talking about using iPads or virtual reality therapy or some sort of fancy piece of technological equipment. Even though ABA can do that, there's all sorts of really cool virtual reality ABA treatments that are out there now. This technological piece is talking about like technical riding, so that you can write up an ABA program. You can sort of write up the recipe of what went into your ABA program. You can publish it, you can share it, and then hopefully people can take those nuts and bolts of what you did in your ABA program and apply it to their own clients, so that it's sort of very stepwise. And somebody from Memphis, Tennessee could share their results with somebody from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and they'll be able to maybe replicate the program that you did in Memphis. So that's kind of cool. Another defining feature of ABA, according to Bear, Wolf, and Risley, is that ABA is conceptually systematic. It is not divorced from theory, right? We do have a lot of theory, especially behavioral theory, that goes into ABA. And so it's not just sort of shooting in the dark and trying to do programs that are divorced from some overarching theoretical framework. It does fit into a theoretical framework, and I think that's kind of neat too. We want it to be effective, so effectiveness is another dimension of ABA. Obviously, we're trying to solve problems, and if something's not working with ABA, it is sort of trial and error, and we can adapt or scrap certain ABA programs. And then the final of the seven defining features, according to Bear, Wolf, and Risley, is that ABA involves generalizability, right? We want to be able, again, with the conceptual systematic piece and the technological piece, take our programs and generalize them to other situations, so that ABA is not just existing in a vacuum for one client in one specific situation. We want ABA to be beneficial and disseminable to everybody, which is really neat. Again, that's sort of the goal of science, and ABA is a science. With ABA being a science, right, you're going to see scientific inquiry. We're going to try to operationally define variables. We're going to quantify, again, using graphs, using SPSS spreadsheets. And we're going to engage in controlled experimentation, which is really neat. So ABA is a science within the broader science of psychology and the behavioral sciences in general. With that behavioral science piece, obviously, it's part of behaviorism. It stems back to the father of behaviorism, who's John B. Watson, right, in the early 1900s. He said that psychology needs to get away from sort of the Freudian subconscious stuff and focus on observable behavior. Environmental stimuli are important. Building on this, right, we had about the same time as John Watson, his contemporary Edward Thorndike, with his law of effect. If something feels good, you're more likely to do it over again. If something feels bad, you're less likely to do it over again. And that became sort of the springboard for B.F. Skinner. And I'm recording this episode in the beginning of April. I want to wish you all a happy belated Burris Day, which was March 20th, B.F. Skinner's birthday, right? The B in B.F. Skinner stands for Burris. B.F. Skinner expanded on the theory of Watson and on the theory of Thorndike's law of effect, and used operant conditioning to control animal behavior. Skinner was very famous for working with rats and pigeons, using rewards and punishment to try to influence behavior sort of in a laboratory setting. Getting closer and closer to modern day ABA, we can take the work of Skinner and apply it to humans. In 1949, this guy by the name of Fuller applied operant conditioning to human subjects. The name of his paper was Operant Conditioning of a Vegetative Human Organism. Not politically correct by today's terms at all. In fact, if you read this article, he talks about feeble-minded and vegetative idiots. But it was taking Skinner's work, which was largely with pigeons and mice, and applying it to humans. And then really modern-day ABA, ABA as we know it today, began in the late 1960s. We have JABA, that was instituted. JABA is the Journal of Applied Behavior Analysis, which is still around today. And then sort of the father of ABA is Dr. Ole Evar Lovaas. Lovaas or Luvaas is a Norwegian name. Evar Lovaas was born in Norway, immigrated to the United States after World War II, and spent most of his career at UCLA. In 1987, he published one of the most cited papers in autism treatment. It actually was not in JABA, that Journal of Applied Behavioral Analysis. It was actually published in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology, but it was called Behavioral Treatment and Normal Educational and Intellectual Functioning in Young Autistic Children. So Lovaas was famous for using what would be known now as ABA to improve verbal skills in young children, especially young nonverbal children who had pretty severe autism symptomology. Lovaas died back in 2010, and his legacy has been sort of tainted as it's come to light. And just like everything in the autism world, right, there's some controversy. We talked about the baggage with Hans Asperger a few episodes ago. With Lovaas, it's come to light that he was a co-author on a paper that used ABA techniques, operant conditioning techniques, to try to convert. It was basically conversion therapy in young homosexual men to try to turn them straight. And this has led to like official censures by certain ABA societies. And so it's something that the field of ABA is having to reckon with. Lovaas was also sort of controversial in his use of aversives. So sort of using punishment that could be physically undesirable or painful in his ABA practice. And so that use of aversives and the conversion therapy piece is kind of troubling, but Lovaas is still seen as sort of the father of ABA. I think that covers the history of ABA pretty well, or at least pretty briefly. Let's get into some major terms surrounding ABA. And if there's one thing I want you to take from this episode, it's that ABA is not rocket science. It's actually as easy as ABC. And in the field of ABA, we have the three-term contingency model. And the three-term contingency model is sort of also called the ABC model of antecedent behavior consequence. So we can break any behavior down or the cause of any behavior through the ABC model. We can analyze a problem behavior. Let's come up with a problem behavior right now. I'm going to think about my own life. And maybe I'm spending too much money on Starbucks in the morning. I'm going to Starbucks. I'm spending $5 on a coffee. That's the behavior. We can look at what leads up to that, the antecedent. So maybe it's that I didn't get a good night's sleep before. You know, I'm running on 5 or 6 hours of sleep. I'm rushing out the door to my job and I don't have time to make a pot of coffee. But I somehow have time to wait in a Starbucks line. That could be an antecedent. Maybe it's that, I'm sort of lonely. If I live alone, this is not myself, but, and going into a place like Starbucks, provides me social reinforcement, right? They write your name on the cup. The barista might smile at you. You might be around regulars every morning, right? So we can look at things that sort of lead up to that behavior. And then we can look at the consequence, and the consequence can have both negative and positive things associated with it, right? A negative thing might be that $5 is coming out of my wallet. And I'm meaning negative there sort of in a moral judgment and not in a behavioral sense of something being taken away. But also I'm getting caffeine. I'm getting sort of a sugar fix. And there could be a lot that's going in. I might be delaying getting to work, and that might be a good thing, right? It might be sort of nice to not get into work on time and to sort of dilly-dally in Starbucks. So we could call that like a maintaining consequence. So we can break any sort of behavior down into antecedents, behaviors, and consequences. And then when we get to the intervention phase, right, we can sort of try to tweak the antecedents, tweak some of the setting events, and then also manipulate the consequences as well. And based on that, we can see if the behavior decreases or maybe even increases in frequency, intensity, and duration. That's basically ABA. There's different ways that you can go about doing that. But again, it's not rocket science. Another thing you'll see in the ABA world sort of related to that three-term contingency model are the four functions of behavior. So it is hypothesized that we do just about everything for four functions. The first is attention. We do things to get attention from other people, whether that's our spouse, our peers, or the barista at Starbucks. And so maybe one of the maintaining things behind the Starbucks visit is you're getting social attention from the barista that writes your name on the coffee cup. The second function of behavior is escape maintained. So you're trying to get out of doing something. So again, maybe going to Starbucks is delaying you getting into work. You don't really like going into work and sitting at your cubicle. It's soul crushing, it's draining, and it's not as happy as sitting in a Starbucks with, you know, whatever Starbucks soundtrack is on, you know, sort of the calming music and the smell of coffee and everything. It's much nicer to sit in Starbucks and people watch than it is to go into your cubicle. So we've covered two functions of behavior: attention, escape. The third function of behavior is it provides access to a tangible. So a tangible could be an item like money. Why do you go to your job? To get a paycheck, which provides access to all sorts of tangibles, right? Food, housing. We do a lot of things for access to tangibles. Or a preferred activity. It could be, especially with children, to get time to play on your tablet or to get to watch an episode of Bluey on the television. With our Starbucks example, you know, imagine yourself holding in your hand that cardboard cup of Starbucks coffee, right? And you're getting access to that tangible cup of Starbucks coffee that provides all different sorts of sensations, right? It feels good to hold in your hand, and then obviously it feels good to drink. So we get a lot of tangible sensations from Starbucks. And then the final function of behavior is automatic. And really with automatic, a lot of times we're thinking about physiological automatic thing. So why, when you have like a mosquito bite, do you scratch it? It's not because you're getting access to a tangible. Nobody's giving you a sticker or a dollar bill for scratching a mosquito bite, right? It's just sort of automatic. It feels good. Why sometimes do you yawn in response to somebody else yawning, right? There's mirror neuron theories behind all of that, but it's just sort of automatic. We do certain things sometimes that are automatic. Why are your eyes blinking right now? Why are you breathing right now? It's not escape attention maintained, and it's not access to a tangible maintained. There's just, we do some things because they're automatic. And there could be some automatic stuff that's provided by Starbucks, right? We have sort of a caffeine hit. We definitely have a sugar hit, and that creates physiological sensations that feel good. And there might be some automaticity to Starbucks. And some people might have some sort of caffeine addiction, some sort of caffeine use disorder. They get caffeine withdrawal. We definitely, which is not in the DSM right now, we do have caffeine intoxication, but there is physiological stuff that's provided by caffeine. So ABA not only looks at the three-term contingency model, your antecedents, your behavior, and your consequences, it also looks at the four functions of behavior. When we start to manipulate behaviors, we can use Skinner's operant conditioning or instrumental conditioning. We can use punishment and reinforcement. So if we want to increase the frequency of a behavior, we try to reinforce it, right? We want the behavior to occur more often or occur longer. That's reinforcement. And reinforcement can be divided into positive reinforcement or negative reinforcement. Positive is you're adding something to increase the frequency or duration or whatever of a behavior. And negative is you're taking something away to increase the likelihood that that behavior will occur. So positive reinforcement, thinking about sort of my own parenting experience. I want my almost four-year-old daughter, she turns four in a week, Emerson, to pick up the crayons that are on the floor. And once she picks up the crayons that are on the floor, I'm going to give her a piece of Easter candy that I have sitting on the counter. I want a behavior to increase the picking up of crayons on the floor. We want that to increase. And I'm adding something in her Easter candy. If I want to decrease the frequency of a behavior, we call that negative reinforcement. And sort of the quadrant, usually positive punishment, negative punishment, positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement are presented in like a 2x2 table. Negative reinforcement is sort of the hardest to grasp. You're trying to increase the likelihood that a behavior will occur by taking something away. And one of the ways that I think about negative reinforcement is through fire alarms. My daughter Emerson right now, she probably has a budding anxiety disorder, but she's terrified of fire alarms, right? Because they're loud, they're grating on the senses. Sometimes they have that strobe light. There's a reason behind that, though. When a fire alarm goes off, right, you're supposed to get out of the building. So you're trying to increase the frequency of a behavior, which is getting the hell out of a building if there's the light, you know, the possibility of a fire. And why are you doing that? You're trying to take away something. And usually when we think about negative reinforcement, we're thinking about escape and avoidance. You're trying to escape that loud grating sound from the fire alarm. There's a reason fire alarms don't play like top 40 hits, because you just have people like, you know, dancing in the hallway and stuff in school. We want you to want to get away from it. Another example of negative reinforcement is probably your alarm, right? Nobody likes the sound of the alarm on their phone. You're trying to increase the frequency of a behavior, which is getting your butt out of bed, and you're trying to escape or avoid the grating sound of the alarm that's on your phone. So those are some examples of positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement. Punishment, you're trying to decrease the frequency of a behavior. Positive punishment, you're adding something in. It could be sort of my strict dad voice with Emerson. So let's say that she's mean to her baby brother, Rowan. She pushes him down. I add in, I don't like her pushing Rowan down. I'm trying to decrease the frequency of that behavior. And so I add in my mean dad voice, which doesn't work, by the way. So I'm adding something in. It could also be, you know, making somebody do a chore or something like that. You're adding something in that to decrease the frequency of a behavior. So I say, you know, if you push Rowan down, you're going to have to go in your room and pick up all of your toys, which is something she should be doing anyway. Decreasing the frequency of a behavior, adding something in, the chore piece, whatever. Negative punishment is trying to decrease the frequency of a behavior by taking something away. You're removing something. A classic example of this is timeout. So let's say Emerson, you know, pushes Rowan down. We want to decrease the frequency of that behavior. So we take something away. We remove stimuli. We put her in her room for 3 minutes or whatever. Operant conditioning, not rocket science, and has been around for 70 or 80 years. I will say, though, even though it's not rocket science, it can be very difficult to apply, even for psychologists. So right now we're dealing with this thing with Emerson where she does not like to go to church. Church is not reinforcing for her. And so we'll go, we'll sit in church. Church is about an hour long. And she'll use a variety of like either escape maintained or attention maintained behaviors to get out of going to church. So we might walk into church, we sit down in a pew, and she'll use escape maintained behavior. So immediately she says, I have to go potty, I have to go to the restroom. We take her to the restroom just in case she has to go. And she, you know, sort of skips through the aisle at church, waving to people and everything, getting out of the pew. She does her business. She comes back in. And then 2 minutes later, she's like, I got to go potty again. We know that she doesn't have to go to the bathroom because she just went. It's obviously escape maintained. And then if we say, no, you know, you don't have to go to the bathroom. You're just trying to get out of sitting here in church. She starts going to sort of attention maintained stuff. So she actually starts yelling, and this is super embarrassing for Lauren and I, my wife and I, that she has to poop. So she'll be like, I have to go poop, loud enough to like people in church are turning and looking at us, right? She's using this attention maintained behavior to try to escape, right? So she's sort of switching up her strategies, which is really difficult. The overall goal is to get out of being in church. We've tried some different tactics, right? We try bringing snacks in to make church a more pleasurable experience for her. Last week in church, you know, we brought in some Cheerios and graham crackers or whatever, and she threw them in the air and sort of made it rain Cheerios on the people in rows around us, which was very embarrassing. And also attention maintained, right? What better way to get attention than pelting people around you with food? So that's been very difficult for us. We've tried to, like, Emerson's super, super smart. So allow her to understand sort of what's going on in church. We're Catholic. We go to Mass. And so maybe we thought if we got her like a pop-up book of the Mass that she could follow along. And it's really interactive. Like she can put different clothes on the priest based on what he's wearing. And like there's different pop-up pieces. And that worked a little bit, but it's still not a reinforcing experience for her. So even though AVA or even though operant conditioning is not rocket science. It can be sort of difficult to institute. I think the next thing we might go with is like a church bingo game or something, where she's able to sort of watch certain things, mark them on a bingo card, and then if she gets bingo, she gets some sort of treat. I don't know. We can also use incompatible behavior. So one of the things ABA will use is to try to promote an alternative behavior. So instead of like talking, saying, screaming, I've got to poop, and acting like a holy terror in church, we could come up with an alternative behavior. And we don't want to do the dead man rule. So the dead man rule related to ABA is you don't want to prescribe something that a dead person can do. And oftentimes teachers, you ask, like, what do you want this class clown to do? And they say, you know, I want them to sit down and be quiet. I want them to sit still and be quiet. And that's not a good alternative behavior because a dead person could do it. We want to prescribe behaviors, alternative behaviors that are active, that a dead person couldn't do. We don't want them to violate the dead person rule. So with Emerson, while ideally we would like for her to sort of be quiet in church, that's not an acceptable alternative behavior. And so what's something that you can't do at the same time you're yelling, I gotta poop? Well, we brought suckers, lollipops into church, right? If you have a lollipop in your mouth, you can't yell, I've gotta poop. A dead person, I don't think, can eat a lollipop. And so that's been one of our solutions. It's an alternative, incompatible behavior. We'll see how it works, but there's only so many suckers or lollipops we can bring into church, and the sugar also makes things worse. This is just a very superficial view of ABA. ABA gets much more complex than this. But let's talk about some of the applications of ABA, because it can be applied to so many different areas. It can be applied to communication, language stuff. That's what Luvas was originally doing. We can teach things like nonverbal communication, eye contact, nodding your head, yes, shaking your head, no, giving a thumbs up, making requests, saying yes, no. These are all programs that I've worked on in ABA before. I'm super adaptable. Sort of related to this, we can teach social skills. We can teach turn-taking and conversation. We can teach sort of the serve and return flow of conversation where somebody asks you how your day is and then you ask them how your day is back, that sort of thing. We can do it for self-help skills. I had an ABA client whose parent really wanted them to be able to sort of fold towels. Her ultimate goal, and this was sort of a vocational skill application too, because we can teach job skills with ABA, is that at the YMCA, they employed individuals with developmental disabilities, adults with developmental disabilities, who were able to sort of fold towels and then put them on the desk sort of when you scan in at the gym at the YMCA. And this was something that was really important to her. She wanted her son to have some financial freedom later in life, wanted him to be able to fold towels. He could help out around the house and then help out in the community and maybe get a job on towel folding. And he was also really precise. He liked sort of the texture of towels, and it was something that sort of fit for him. So we did a towel folding program with ABA, which was pretty cool. So we can teach self-help skills. We can teach calling 911, emergency sorts of things. ABA can be used sort of occupational therapy-wise. You can teach motor skills, which is kind of cool. Academically, you can teach academic skills. ABA can be applied to academic tutoring. It's really cool. You can teach play and leisure stuff. There's just so many different applications of ABA. I mentioned before when I was talking about technology, there's virtual reality ABA that's out there right now, which is really, really neat. There's just all sorts. There's no limit on what you can do with ABA, which I think is really cool. And ABA is expanding sort of beyond the narrow window of observable behavior, the black box of the mind, right? We're taking into account now that behaviors can be internal. Right? A cognition is an internal behavior. Neurotransmitters in your brain or in your body are observable behaviors. They're not observable, you know, in the way that sort of tapping your foot or playing with your hair is, but we're sort of broadening the definition of what an observable behavior is. And I say observable behavior, we definitely want an operational definition of a behavior. So a lot of times I'll sit down with a parent and I'll say, you know, what would you like to work on? And they say, I would like to work on my child is bad. Bad is not an operational definition. I need specific discrete behaviors. You know, is it saying curse words? Is it pinching a sibling? We need to get a very good measurable definition of what being bad is. We also need to get sort of a definition that is discrete. So I'll ask how often a behavior is occurring, and a lot of times from parents will say all the time. It's constant. They're bad constantly. Well, we know it's not going on interminably. We need to come up with a definition that we can count. So one of the things with ABA is we like really countable behaviors. So getting an operational definition is a big start to the ABA process. Also starting the ABA process, a lot of times with your alphabet soup, you'll hear of FBAs, which are functional behavior assessments. Schools like to do FBAs, especially with problem behaviors, to determine the function of the behavior, and that three-term contingency model sort of conceptualization of what a behavior is. But you might have, especially if you work in a school system, have heard the term FBA before. FBA stands for functional behavior assessment. Also, at the start of ABA, we like to find out what's reinforcing to somebody. Obviously, we can't increase the frequency of a behavior if we don't know what motivates that person. And so you'll see sort of different motivational assessments to see maybe this child likes social reinforcers. They like high fives. They like hugs. They like verbal praise, like good job, awesome. Maybe they like things that are tangible, that are physical, stickers, candy, and it can get controversial using food as a reinforcer. Whole nother controversy with an ABA. But we like to pick out what's going to motivate a child. And so doing sort of a reinforcement menu, a reinforcement assessment on the front end of ABA is really important. I mentioned that ABA can look very different based on the practitioner, based on the setting. Sort of the granddaddy, the OG of ABA is DTT, more alphabet soup, but DTT stands for discrete trial training. Lou Voss was big on discrete trial training. And this is using trials. This can look very cold. It can look very robotic. But you're doing a certain number of trials in a session. So let's say you have an hour-long ABA session, and you're doing a trial on eye contact. You're trying to increase eye contact. And you might do 20 discrete trials trying to increase eye contact within that hour-long session. And ultimately, you want sort of independent eye contact. So we use a hierarchy of prompts a lot of times with ABA. So an example in running sort of an eye contact program, you're doing one of your 20 trials during session. You want, ideally, the child to be independent. That would be the first of the hierarchy, the lowest of the hierarchy of prompts. And so you might say the child's name. And if they look at you, if they make eye contact, you can check off that they're independent on that trial. That would be the best outcome in an eye contact trial, independent. The next step might be gesture. And so you might say the child's name, they don't look at you, and sort of you point to your eyes, or you do some sort of gesture to try to have the child make eye contact with you. That would be sort of a step down from independent, but still okay, and we would call that sort of gesture in hierarchy of prompts. The next in the hierarchy could be like a physical prompt. And so the child, you say their name, they're still not looking at you. You gesture, you point to your eyes to remind them to look at you. They're still not doing it. You might tap their chin as a gesture, as a physical prompt. That could be a physical prompt. And you can mark that with a P in your hierarchy of prompts. And then maybe if they're still not making eye contact after the physical prompt, after you tap their chin, you might just gently guide their head to where they're looking you at the eye, looking you in the eyes. And we could call that sort of a manual or hand over hand prompt. And that would be sort of the most structured prompt. So you're seeing a lot of Vygotskian scaffolding with ABA too. Ideally, most ABA programs are seeking mastery. And a lot of times mastery is defined as doing 80% independent. And so if out of those 20 trials, you're at 80% independent, so you're independent for 16 of the 20 trials, we might say that you've mastered that program. Usually we want mastery for two or three sessions in a row, and then we put that program on what we call maintenance. And we might come back to it in a few weeks to make sure that you still have the skills. Obviously, this can look very different based on ABA practitioners, but this is something that I've seen a lot in ABA practice. Again, that's discrete trial training because you're doing discrete trials. You're doing a certain number of prescribed trials per ABA session. Again, this can look cold, it can look mechanical, it can look artificial, and it can be sort of forced, right? Because you're forcing a certain amount of trials into a session, and it's not super organic. We're not allowing the opportunity to really come to us. We're forcing the issue, trying to do this set number of trials within a session. And so an alternative to discrete trial training, to DTT, is PRT, which stands for Pivotal Response Training. PRT is more naturalistic. It's less structured. You're sort of taking what the child gives you. So you're going more based off of child motivation than trying to force a certain number of trials into a session. Interactions are more naturalistic. If one day the child's not really feeling something or there's a certain problem behavior that's occurring more often that the parent's concerned about, you don't really necessarily have to force all of the programs that you're working on into the session. You can sort of take what the child or parent gives you and do child initiations instead of what we usually think about with DTT is therapist-initiated interactions. So that's kind of cool. I'm more of a PRT person. You know, there's a time and a place. You can mix DTT and PRT. Really good therapists can sort of weave in and out of DTT and PRT to where they're not team PRT or team DTT. There's a time and a place for both. And I think that sort of flexibility as an ABA practitioner is really important. So, wow, this is turning into maybe my longest episode ever. I was mentioning ABA practitioner. Let's get into some more alphabet soup about different terms you might have heard related to practitioners of ABA. And so sort of the most basic level of ABA practice is being an RBT. RBT stands for Registered Behavior Technician. And they work under the supervision of a BCBA, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Usually an RBT, you don't have to have a college degree. It's a little bit looser on who can qualify as an RBT. There's not necessarily a standardized exam that you have to pass. A lot of times you just sort of do a little bit of training under a BCBA, maybe get a few hours in a certain setting, and then you can call yourself an RBT. And based on what state you're in, registered is part of the acronym of RBT, you might have to get licensure or certification in that state, hence the registered piece. They work under the supervision of a BCBA. A BCBA is much more strict, much more intensive to get. And you can run an ABA clinic if you have your BCBA. You need to have at least your master's degree in behavior analysis. Or you could have a master's degree sometimes in education, psychology, social work, some mental health allied field. But you have to have specific coursework related to behavior analysis. And you have to pass the and within that related field, you have to pass on this course sequence that's approved by the BACB. The BACB also has this bear of an exam that you have to pass to become a BCBA. And then you also have to accumulate so many hours of ABA practice. And in most states, you need a license to practice as a BCBA. Some places, some states have another alphabet soup acronym, which is the BCABA. If you're a BCABA, you're a board-certified assistant behavior analyst or analyst. Board-certified assistant behavior analyst. I mean, again, this alphabet soup thing is so hard. One of the criticisms I have about ABA is that it's not, even though we want to make it accessible, acronyms and technical language a lot of times make ABA much more complicated than it needs to be. B.F. Skinner, we can do a whole nother episode on like verbal operants, but he had his own sort of language that he created of tacts and mans and just interverbals and like all of these different terms that are sort of common sense, but he gave like really weird, strange names to. And I think oftentimes we like overcomplicate what ABA is. But anyways, going back to that BCABA, that board certified assistant behavior analyst, these people usually have a bachelor's degree. They don't have that master's degree and haven't completed all of that coursework approved by the BACB. But they're a step up above RBTs. They're still working under the supervision of a BCBA, but a lot of times they're working towards their BCA, a BCBA. So it's sort of like a transitional, not degree, but transitional title. Again, it doesn't exist everywhere. So you'll see alphabet soup, again, related to just about everything ABA. Wow, this has been a long episode. And again, I feel like this has been really cursory, really basic, that I'm leaving out all sorts of things related to ABA. You can get your master's degree in ABA, right? So we could go, I could probably do a podcast related to just about everything that we talked about in this podcast. If you have questions on this, send me an email, because I'm happy to do follow-up episodes on ABA. I'm not a BCBA myself. Several of my colleagues have passed the BCBA exam and are BCBAs, in addition to being psychologists. I haven't really found it necessary to take the BCBA exam. I feel like sort of being a licensed psychologist, like, it doesn't add that much having your BCBA. You can still do sort of the scope of practice that you would be able to do with your BCBA, but I'm willing to hear alternate opinions. Maybe I can go back and get my BCBA. I have practiced ABA before under the supervision. This was when I was in grad school. And there's so many things that I like about ABA. There's also controversy related to ABA. A lot of people claim that ABA is sort of like animal training, right? It's the same sort of, again, operant conditioning with Skinner came out of training pigeons and rats. It's the same sort of thing that you might see, same sort of principles you might see in dog obedience school. And so one of the criticisms of ABA is that, you know, it's sort of like training an animal. The counter to that is, like, all learning sort of follows that same formula, whether you're a slug or a dog or a person. Learning and behavior occur for the same reasons. That would be sort of a counter to that. Another criticism of ABA is that we're trying to train away certain neurodiverse things that we shouldn't necessarily be intervening in. Like, the simple fact that we have interventions for autism implies that autism needs some sort of intervention, and maybe autism doesn't need an intervention. Maybe, you know, we shouldn't be trying to fit round things into square, round pegs into square holes, or whatever the phrase is, right? That being diverse is a good thing, and we shouldn't train away that neurodiversity of thought. Another counter to that, right, is that maybe ABA isn't appropriate for everybody with autism. But, you know, I think most people would say that somebody that's nonverbal with autism, it'd be really good if we could get them speaking and communicating. We don't want to take the autism away. We want to be able to teach skills, and these skills can be taught to people both on and off the spectrum. And off the spectrum, you are seeing ABA applied to something like ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, very much based out of the ABA world, which is kind of cool. So I understand some of the criticisms of ABA. I do feel like ABA has been inappropriately practiced by some people. I also feel like all ABA is not created equally. But I am sort of more of a behaviorist at heart than I am anything else sort of related to psychology. And so there's a lot about ABA that I like. Whew. All right. Let's look at the mailbag. Again, this was a mailbag request. Even if it's 2 years later, I'll try to get to it. This mailbag request came in a couple of days ago, and it's from a freshman in high school in LA. And they write, as a member of the LGBTQ plus community, I've been wondering more and more about the risk factors and psychopathologies associated with various aspects of the LGBTQ community. I've been worried about how social communities cope with situations where there is internal conflict as well as external attacks, especially in the wake of the Nashville Covenant shooting, which hits close to home here, being a Tennessean, and Nashville's my second home, and I've driven past that school and church numerous times. Back to the letter. I've been struggling to understand the intricacies of how different people react to and experience the world as a member of a minority group from a psychological perspective. This is so well written from a freshman in high school. Additionally, I've been wondering about how growing up, especially in this day and age, as a member of the LGBTQ plus community impacts children. Personally, I've been through lots of different psychiatric and psychological treatments, and some of them may or may not have been beneficial. And I guess what I'm trying to articulate is I'm very confused in this modern age what it means to be a minority and how that's changing. There's so much access to hatred and support at the same time. And there's so many different voices saying so many different things that it's hard to separate right and wrong. And I'm wondering how that affects young members of minority groups. They say, I understand this email is poorly worded. It's not. This is super well articulated. And I'm genuinely unsure on how to articulate these thoughts and ideas. And then they sign their name, but I'm not going to read their name off here for anonymity purposes. But this is a super important topic. And it's something that's really hard to articulate. And so I'll try to do that in one of my upcoming episodes. I'm going to try to, this is going to be really difficult for me to do, but process, make sense of some recent events, talk about risk factors, talk about sort of the intricacies in not pathologizing somebody's orientation, but at the same time, if you're rejected by your family, if you're at greater risk for suicide because of all of this societal pressure, like how do we provide access to those people without pathologizing them? So that's something I hope to cover in a future episode. If you have future episode ideas, requests, comments about this episode or other episodes, send them to me at ctayhello41@cbu.edu. That's more than enough for this episode. Until the next one, take care and stay well.